Okay, so I'm calling this one Myths, Distortions, and Assumptions About Climate Change, and it's a complicated topic, and there's this idea that you can easily mislead people about certain points of it. So we'll go over some of these myths that have arisen and sort of the logical progression behind them and where that can sort of get tripped up. So one thing that's often stated is that climate has always been changing, and basically this is a true statement, but the conclusion that people want you to draw from that is false. So the implied conclusion is that human-caused climate change presents no particular danger. And the assumption that connects those things is that climate just is. It doesn't have drivers, and the real truth is that things like the ice ages are driven by changes in the orbital characteristics of the Earth, and there are also sort of shorter term natural variations like El Nino and a few other teleconnections. Those have relatively small magnitude of change and sort of localized. So it turns out that greenhouse gases are what you really need to be concerned with on the time scale of a century or so. And sort of going along with this is this statement that the greenhouse effect is natural. And I'm saying that this is a more encompassing twist on a just slightly different statement: a natural greenhouse effect exists. So a natural greenhouse effect exists is a really true statement. So I'll draw an analogy to here at Holden. You can say in the area of Holden Village, bears are natural. They exist here. But if you were to extend that and say, well, that means I can just throw a bunch of food waste out on any place around here, you're going to start running into problems. So, you know, those natural bears exist, but you don't want to enhance that that issue of bears. So two threads of logic that people might follow. One is the natural greenhouse effect exists, therefore humans have no impact, don't worry. The real truth is the quantity of greenhouse gases matters, so there's a natural baseline, and then there's a human caused enhanced amount of greenhouse gases, so watch out. And we had a little bit of discussion about this idea. It's only a theory, and the term theory really is a very strong word to scientists. So discussed that a little bit in Wednesday's session, and had some discussion at breakfast yesterday, and Jason says scientists need to come up with some better way of expressing that. So, you know, I sort of agree with him.
We changed to saying climate science because we realized that people, no matter how many times you tried to re-explain what a theory was, nobody got it. Mm-hmm. And so we just said saying climate change science. And that tested with our audience as people understand what that means, mm-hmm. that this is real, versus mm-hmm. theory. They thought, just a theory.
Yeah. So, yeah, the best kind of rephrasing that I could come up with quickly was to say, doing the math. So if you start with an increase in greenhouse gases and then do the math, you end up with climate change. So I don't know. I'll have to stew on that a little bit more.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, in high school we learned that scientific theory is quite different than just a theory or a guess. And it's, I guess a lot of people have forgotten what a scientific science
Well, apparently
is.
You retain that better than Jason's listeners.
Right.
non-listeners then.
Yeah.
Well, he's a Holden villager, so you're expecting to be able to say
All right, so actually I heard this one soon after I moved to Ann Arbor quite a few years ago from another meteorologist, and he said, we can't predict next week's weather, so we can't predict climate. The first part is true, the second part is false, and again, one of the assumptions that's connecting that, climate just is but has no drivers. So the underlying cause behind climate is all of these long-term drivers, the greenhouse gases, and then even longer term, the orbital characteristics, and some of those other things. Whereas the drivers for weather on the short term are really the initial conditions. So what the circulation of the overall atmosphere is today gives you a pretty good indication of what it's going to be like tomorrow. And then when you step further out in time, there comes to be more uncertainty in that, and weather is quite unpredictable over 2 weeks, but you're still in the same climate regime. You still kind of have the same chances of a certain type of weather over the long term. And with increasing greenhouse gas forcing, that's GHG stands for greenhouse gas, the overlap between possible weather of the past and the future, they start to separate. The overlap between them diminishes. So there's this sort of myth that weather equals climate, and the implication behind that is that our assessment of climate should change as regularly as the weather changes. So, you know, if you're a climate change believer, you're going to really pay attention when it gets warm and kind of not pay quite as much attention when it's unusually cold, and vice versa if you're a denier. So an example that I showed in Wednesday's talk is this map here that shows really unusually cold temperatures in the part of the United States that I'm from for January through March of this year. It was very cold, and you know, that happened despite these overall climate trends. So it's not something that you should expect to continue, and it really didn't prove anything one way or the other.
But it was very cold.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Okay, so the best observational answers come from global data over several decades. And a satirical rejoinder, I read this on one of the climate change doubter websites, had a cartoon showing Al Gore saying, "Weather isn't climate, except when we say it is." So, you know, you can twist that idea around any way that you want. And this is really a review of a big section of Wednesday's talk. Myth is that the idea of greenhouse gases was invented out of the whole cloth in the 1980s. But the truth is that major contributing pieces came over a long time. And what I consider to be the birth of the modern understanding of greenhouse gas-induced climate change was Manabe and Weatherald in 1967. So I'm planning a 50th anniversary celebration for that of some sort. Now, another thing that you hear sometimes, they told us the opposite in the 1970s, that the world is getting colder and we're headed into an ice age. And that's sort of true, but I call it spin and misinterpretation. So what people were talking about in the 1970s was that we are now trending under the natural Milankovitch cycle, which is the changes in orbital properties of the Earth, we're trending toward a cool period under that driving mechanism. And people got excited because there were several cold winters in the late 1970s, and there were major lake effect snowstorms that happened in Buffalo in particular. There were a few really publicity-seeking scientists who got the attention of the media. So it got a fair amount of attention, but I'm saying this media frenzy, in contrast to anthropogenic global warming, was short-lived and involved few scientists, but it's remembered well by some of the climate change doubters. And the particular person who is properly cited for switching sides is Stephen Schneider. So he was a prominent spokesman of this idea back in the 1970s, and then later became a prominent spokesman for warming in the future later on. And scientists who really seek a lot of publicity are kind of rare, but Stephen Schneider was one of them. He's actually now deceased, but
What did AGW stand for?
Anthropogenic Global Warming.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have a question about the Milankovitch cycle. Can you describe that, explain that just a little bit?
The main type of Milankovitch cycle is really about how the closest approach of the Earth to the Sun during its orbit corresponds to the tilt of the Earth, which season we're in. So presently, the Earth approaches closest to the Sun during January, Northern Hemisphere winter, and ice ages tend to occur when it's the opposite. So,
meaning that the
we're farthest from the Sun.
I'm confused. Right, but. But this, like, is this like a 1,000-year cycle? How big is that cycle?
It's that particular one is about 50,000 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is that cycle still going on now?
It is still going on.
It's still going on. So that cycle, which leads to colder temperatures, right, is still going on, and yet we are experiencing warmer temperatures.
That trend toward colder temperatures due to that effect is very slow in comparison to the greenhouse gas caused warming.
Okay.
So the next thing, it hasn't been warming since 1998. This is sort of true. There hasn't been a statistically significant trend in global temperatures during that time. So the implied conclusion is that no warming due to humans has ever occurred. That is false. So I really consider this to be a cherry-picked fact. And it's not really a basis for judging the validity of the overall idea. And in truth, trends in ocean temperature have continued, and that was actually fairly prominently in the news a couple of weeks ago, that a lot of that heat has been stored in the Atlantic Ocean. So, I reserve judgment a little bit on that exact explanation, but that may be true. But also, the 14 warmest years worldwide have occurred during the period 1998 to 2013. So even though there's not a significant trend during that time, it's a high enough plateau that those temperatures exceed everything that preceded. Okay, this one I got from a radio host in Ann Arbor, but I think he probably got it from somewhere else. And he said, climate is all driven by the oceans. It has nothing to do with greenhouse gases. So the first sentence is true, the second sentence is false, and the assumption that I think a lot of people would think maybe is true is that oceans require warmer air in order to increase in temperature. Does anyone want to guess at what the truer explanation is?
The air needs warmer oceans to increase in temperature?
That's kind of the first sentence there that I said is true, but yeah, that's not...
Greenhouse effect occurred within that water itself.
Yeah, I guess really what I'd say is it drives the water. The greenhouse gases are able to directly warm the ocean without the air temperature really being a prerequisite to it. So this really, to me, is the most important driver of global warming in the long run, that those greenhouse gases are warming the ocean, and that builds up slowly over time. So that's really driving the whole atmosphere.
Can you explain how they warm the ocean?
They directly emit infrared radiation. So it's invisible light that carries heat right into the ocean, and it's absorbed there.
Mm. Sort of like a microwave heats the cup of water.
Okay, so because there are more greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, the sun, as it's going through, heats the ocean more directly?
No, the invisible radiation from the atmosphere goes into the ocean and is absorbed there and heats it up.
Okay. But does it bypass the air above the ocean? It's not heating the air above the ocean?
No, its source is the air above the ocean.
So it's like serves as a transferring agent, the air.
It's like sunscreen that has a lower SPF.
Is it because the air
goes right into the ocean, there's no...
If it reaches the top of the ocean, it goes into the ocean, and there's more of it that reaches the top of the ocean.
So the reverse, as I understand, is greenhouse gases reflect that radiant energy away from the Earth before it hits our atmosphere, normally.
Say that again?
Greenhouse, the gases in the high atmosphere reflect the radiant energy in the high atmosphere normally, and as there's changing high atmosphere, those energies aren't reflected as much, so they transmit more directly into the lower atmosphere, into the Earth. That was my understanding. Why do greenhouse gases change the radiations? Because they are a protective thing normally.
Yeah, I think maybe you're thinking of ozone.
Well, that, et cetera.
Yeah. ozone is a greenhouse gas, but the thing you're talking about more is its interaction with sunlight rather than infrared light.
Hmm. Where does the infrared light come from if not the sun?
It is emitted by you and the floor, and everything around us has emission of infrared radiation.
Okay.
So it's really sourced from everything. And the greenhouse gases are what are capable of absorbing and emitting thermal radiation. This is actually going to be a future slide here. The other gases in the atmosphere, mainly nitrogen and oxygen, they essentially do not absorb or emit infrared radiation.
Would the water warm much more quickly than the air because it has such a higher specific heat?
It warms more slowly, but it's able to hold it in and allow it to accumulate over a very long time. So it will increase in temperature gradually, but inexorably.
And same way, in order to decrease in temp, would take a long time to.
Yes.
Just went past and past. So the infrared coming off the greenhouse gases, this infrared radiation, is that the right word?
Mm-hmm.
Is that, it's just plain outright radiation, it's not from chemical interaction or?
Yeah, it's basically light in a invisible wavelength.
Okay.
Yeah, so, actually going back to that concept, there are infrared cameras and so forth that you can point at buildings to see where they're leaking heat. There are military applications to infrared viewers. You can see people at night because they're emitting more infrared, and vehicles will emit some infrared. So, those are some of the examples of how it's in the environment, but in the atmosphere, it's the greenhouse gases that interact with them.
So it sounds like you're saying there's infrared radiation is almost anything that other than the greenhouse gases, anything in the environment that radiates heat that the oceans can absorb, rather than the greenhouse gases. Anything in the atmosphere that radiates heat, like by a person or anything or a building, can be absorbed by something like the ocean or a lake. Okay.
The main thing that the ocean would be exposed to, though, would be the atmosphere.
Okay, but that's separate from greenhouse gases. That's where we're getting confused. I mean, that's a separate entity.
Well, it depends on how great the concentration of greenhouse gases is in the atmosphere.
Okay.
So we already discussed this one a little bit. Carbon dioxide concentration has gone from 280 to 400 parts per million. That's a tiny number. But the truth is it's important because that's the human-caused gas that interacts with infrared light. H2O has kind of more of a indirect path to interaction and really is a multiplier of the effect of CO2. Some people like to say that warming is due to the sun. This is false, and its assumption is self-contained. They're just assuming that it's due to the sun. Truth is that solar irradiance has decreased since 1980. And the global temperature trend has gone the opposite direction. So one of the things that you can look for is the fingerprints of climate as driven by greenhouse gases. So on Wednesday we talked about decreased stratospheric temperatures. So increased greenhouse gases drive increased temperatures near the surface, but actually the opposite in the stratosphere, above about 10 miles. And probably I can talk offline if people really want to understand how that happens. It'll take a while. Next is the equator to pole temperature gradient. Greenhouse gases are more effective at warming the Earth at higher latitudes and less effective near the equator. So actually one point of agreement between climate models and observations is that the greatest amount of warming has occurred and is projected to occur in Alaska and eastern Siberia. So those high latitude areas have the greatest amount of warming. And then another point is the daily temperature range. Again, predicted by models and observed, the greatest amount of warming occurs at night rather than during the day, as driven by greenhouse gases. Now, if these changes were driven by the sun, these outcomes would not be the same. So another thing that people have said to me is it's all about politics, not science. And this is a long statement from Sir Peter Gluckman, who is a top science advisor for New Zealand. And I think the bold part was inserted by Judith Curry. I got this off of her website. So this is saying that the real scientific debate has been pushed aside in favor of a proxy debate where people are trying to defend their economic interests and pass on the burden of this to the next generation of people, and science can easily get damaged in such proxy debates. So diagramming proxy debate on the I use the phrase an inconvenient truth, and I labeled science as truth and politics as inconvenient. So on the science side, the largest questions are firmly answered, but some rough edges remain on some details. And information is strongly filtered when passed on to the public. In the political arena, it ends up being very polarized and values-based. So different people have different values, and that drives their outlook on this. It depends on direct appeal to the public, and science often gets mangled. Uncertainty is a dirty word. Scientists kind of understand that word. And again, maybe we need to find a different word to communicate that idea to the public. So the real central ideas of global warming are subject to a low level of uncertainty, and some of the more detailed aspects of it have greater amounts of uncertainty. And then the political debate is really focused on actions and solutions versus none. So people who are economically motivated to have no action taken on prevention of climate change, their real goal is to have the political debate result in no action. They're not so concerned about what the scientific truth is. And then I've also had people say this to me: it can't be true, because if it is, we have to do something. So this is just the proxy debate, and assumes that the values-driven piece of it can decide the scientific questions. So at this point, I think I'd like to pause a little bit and see if anyone else has examples of myths that they want to discuss.
I've seen just some examples. There's less snowfall in Norway, less snowfall in the Appalachians, the southern Appalachians.
Mm-hmm.
But is it weather more extreme, both as far as wet, dry?
and temperature-wise, cold and heat? Is that what is, is that happening?
Yeah, there's more uncertainty involved in some of those results, but the basic thrust is greater extremes in storms. I think it's really tough to make a case for more extreme cold. So yeah, people have kind of twisted themselves in knots to say that cold temperatures in the Midwest during the first part of 2014 were caused by global climate change, and it's really tough to make that case. I tend to say it's despite, you know, it's a natural aberration.
So what's your comment for us on the ocean rising 1 to 3 feet and the polar ice caps shrinking?
Yeah, those the Arctic Ocean ice has been decreasing, and ocean levels are rising and are projected to continue. And those are really very robust results of human-caused climate change. So actually, on my next slide, I'll jump ahead to this, but sometimes kind of simplistic assumptions are made about the impacts of things, and this is from a recent issue of Science magazine that I put in my pack and read on the plane coming out here. So this is offering a more complex view on the possibility of low-lying islands in the Pacific disappearing. And so these are very low-lying coral atolls in the Pacific. And the easy answer that has been presented before is they're almost certain to go underwater within X number of years. And there's now more of a debate on whether the coral can build up quickly enough to counteract ocean level rise. So you really have to consider both sides of that equation before you reach a conclusion on whether they're going to end up underwater. So there's active debate on that point. And that, nevertheless, does not negate the whole idea of climate change.
Does the Great Lakes Experimental Research Laboratory have a website that explains things to lay people? Or is there another website that explains things in a simple way that you find trustworthy?
Yeah, I had more of that in Wednesday's presentation, but I would say probably some of the best sources. One is called skepticalscience.com. So that title is reclaiming the skeptical label from the deniers. And among scientists, skepticism is considered a virtue. So skepticalscience.com, realclimate.org, another one. Various government agencies, climate.gov is kind of a centralized NOAA website related to climate. And then, yeah, there are non-governmental organizations that have some of them too. And actually, in one of the next slides, I'm recommending the .earth blog by Andrew Revkin, which is associated with the New York Times. So yeah, I've sort of introduced this concept here. Some people can get caught in this myth that anything that can go wrong will. So this idea of a balance between ocean level rise and corals building up the islands, you know, that's a tricky business. So some of these impacts of climate change, people miss some of the nuances. So my recommendation is, if you're a climate change believer, science is generally on your side. Be careful about jumping ahead of it. And on the next slide, I'm kind of pointing out that some of the arguments that people try to make are almost equivalent to going up to someone's face and saying, "Duh." So relying on this assumption that other people will think that what you're saying is obvious, it's not a good way of presenting things. So I'm saying it carries a variety of underlying meanings, almost certainly not meeting with scientific standards. And this approach pervades both camps in the proxy debate. And I recommend Andrew Revkin as someone who tries to give a balanced viewpoint on a lot of these things. So one example of this kind of reasoning is, several years ago, someone said, "Hurricane Katrina proved that climate change is real," and really it didn't. The tragedy of that was due to a lot of problems with the infrastructure and lack of proper action in the wake of it, and there are a lot of things that contributed to that. This slide is about the research that I've been working on and some mistakes that were made in projection of evaporation from the land surrounding the Great Lakes. So there is a very simplistic model that was developed for evaporation from the land surrounding the Great Lakes. And it said that there's just a huge amount of increase in evaporation due to climate change. And a more careful assessment of it said that amount of increase in evaporation just isn't possible. There's not enough energy there to increase evaporation by that much, and therefore the estimates of changes in lake levels due to climate change are in error. So the reasons here are more technical than I really want to get into, but my research has kind of been rolling back that particular impact of climate change. And again, it doesn't negate the reality of climate change. And also, I'll point out that the overall question of greenhouse gas-induced climate change has been looked at by thousands of researchers. This particular one was really formulated by just one person, and a number of other people kind of got on that bandwagon and used that method as a black box and kept coming up with similar results, and therefore assumed it was right.
They weren't skeptical enough, in other words.
They weren't skeptical enough, no. And it's been very prominently promoted in the media over the past 20 years. So I really published my results 3 years ago, and most of the scientists have come to my side on this, but a few of them who actually are quite powerful have not. I'm going to quickly go over this one because it's not really my area of specialty, but I derived this from this article, "Shattering Myths to Help the Climate, Things That Are More Economic Related." I'll concentrate a little bit on number one: the enormous uncertainty of climate change argues for a wait and see strategy. I argue with the word enormous there, and also argue that there are simple actions that can at least be started to try to counter it. And I'd also like to concentrate on number five. It's pointless for Americans to reduce CO2 emissions since unilateral action won't solve global warming. The thing is, most countries are waiting for the U.S. to take action or take more decisive action than they have already taken. So the U.S. is really a leader in this. Some recurring threads throughout a lot of these myths are confusion between weather and climate, attribution to a cause. So the idea that climate really has no cause, therefore we can't do anything about it, is in error. Climate does have causes over many thousands of years timescales in terms of the Milankovitch cycle, over decadal to century timescales in the case of greenhouse gases. And then there's the proxy debate. Science and politics or economics are not separated the way they ought to be. Confirmation of bias, I didn't really talk about this, but people want to believe what they want to believe. So they'll wait for evidence that agrees with the conclusion that they want to come to. And impatience, the idea that Hurricane Katrina is the thing that proves it, I consider that to be sort of due to impatience. Then, yeah, the last slide, this is just sort of for fun. See if you can figure out, this is going back quite a ways in time and actually points to a different kind of human driver of climate on more of a local basis. So this is a quotation about a very famous person, and it's taken from the biography of this person written by his son, and this is the version that's translated from, I believe, Spanish into English. So saying about rainfall in Jamaica, he knew from experience that formerly this also occurred in the Canary, Madeira, and Azores Islands, but since the removal of forests that once covered those islands, they do not have so much mist and rain as before. So which famous person would have made this observation?
Columbus.
Columbus is correct. So, yeah, he was observing climate change way back then. Although on a more localized basis.
Right.
So, any more discussion on any of the other points?
I have heard it said that there would, the dry climates would become drier and wet climates would become wetter. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, the main argument behind that is that the downward flow of air in the subtropics, so between about 10 and 30 degrees latitude in each hemisphere, that downward flow would become stronger and inhibit rainfall there. So those are the places that are generally dry already. And that enhancement would make them drier.
But would that occur over 500 years, 2,000 years? I mean, is it something that we would even perceive within a couple
it's like
of generations?
The frog in the pot boiling slowly or jumping in? Yeah. Are we not going to really notice?
Yeah, well, it's probably somewhat less noticeable than the change in temperature, because there's more noisiness to precipitation than there is to temperature.
What do you mean by that? More noisiness?
More news coverage?
Yeah, more natural variability.
Huh.
So yeah, the precipitation can come in the form of very extreme events in a short period of time, whereas the temperature is more of a continuous characteristic of the atmosphere.
So, AGW, anthropological?
Anthropogenic.
Cogenic. So, yeah. Does it have roots?
Human cause.
Yeah. Human cause and or cogenic. It's a when you said that people are that the world is waiting for the United States to make a move, I wonder about that because I feel like so much of the world has been striving to be like the industrialized America, and a lot of them are moving on that pattern. So even if we do change, I feel like they're going to continue on their theoretical pattern, and then before a change would happen, because they have set these visions of grandeur.
There's a lot of countries who are doing a lot more things to try to go in the opposite direction and stop climate change than we are.
Absolutely. I guess I'm thinking like China,
right? Yeah, well, China has surpassed the U.S. in terms of overall
trying to achieve
greenhouse gas emissions.
Set a goal.
But yeah, in terms of per capita, they haven't caught up with us yet. One of the reasons, in addition to this, that China is taking action is just air pollution.
People are getting sick, breathing air.
Yeah, so particulates and those sort of things from coal combustion are just choking people over there. So they need to find alternatives just because of that. And it seems like they're ahead of us on installation of solar electrical systems.
We're kind of like the ocean. We move real slow into change, and we're too big of a beast.
Yeah, I don't know the numbers, but if you measure it in terms of carbon intensity, dividing carbon dioxide emissions by gross domestic product, we're improving in that respect.
Oh, my brain is popping.
All right, thanks for coming.
Thank you.